We are here on another special episode of Balagan discussing the war in Gaza that, as most of our audience remembers, opened up the Sabbath of October 7th on what we can call the Black Sabbath. So far, the tolls for Israel, more than 1,400 people died, massacred by Hamas people. More than 250 people are held hostage, abducted by Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and we don't know the final number yet. More than 50 people, their location is unknown, and we still have almost 100 bodies that are unidentified because they were in such a horrible shape. But anyway, Israel has been attacking in Gaza now, and a ground effort is being held for almost 2 days. Some good news, though, are that one soldier was released from Hamas captivity yesterday in IDF's operation. So we also have some good news. But today we're going to talk about, you know, politics, the international players, what are the scenarios that we may see. And for that, I have my all-time friend, Jeff, who's back with us. Jeff Becker, sadly speaking to you on these circumstances, but always glad to speak to you, my friend.
Thanks for having me, Kobe.
So, Jeff, let's dive. Where should we start?
Well, there's so much going on. It's so difficult to find like a place to pinpoint where to start. I mean, you know, you have the flare up now on the northern border with Hezbollah. You've got, you know, raids happening in the West Bank at this point. You know, I know there's a lot of concerns now, you know, with increasing settler violence and a lot of concerns that the West Bank is on the verge of boiling up with the, you know, more, I guess, in a way, more importantly, with the war in Gaza going on right now. So basically, you know, as we're speaking on October 30th, you know, the IDF is about a couple days into its ground invasion of the Gaza Strip. Basically, about 2 weeks back, the IDF announced that, you know, all the residents of Gaza City, which is the most populated city in Gaza.
It's actually the most populated Palestinian city with almost 600,000 residents.
Yep. Basically, the IDF made an announcement saying that they were going to have to evacuate down south. They drew a, you know, there's, if you want to find the image, plenty of news outlets have it. But basically, they drew a line through the Gaza Strip saying, you know, that divided north and south, that, you know, basically saying the north is going to be a war zone. This is where we're going to have the bulk of our ground operation activities, and that, you know, civilians need to basically retreat below this line in the Gaza Strip. And, you know, basically what we've been seeing in the last 2 days is the beginnings of the IDF starting to move its forces into the northern part of the Gaza Strip, mainly surrounding Gaza City. And, you know, and this has also come with basically increased bombing campaigns of the Gaza Strip, which I believe we spoke about the casualty numbers in Israel. I believe in Gaza, it's about 8,000 at this point. But
even though we can say that we don't have accurate numbers because the numbers are being provided by Hamas, but yeah, we can assume that the numbers are way higher. Yes,
yeah,
definitely. Speak up.
And yeah, basically, you know, this is pretty much where we're at right now. You know, we'll see how the IDF ground invasion of northern Gaza pans out. But, you know, there is a real concern of, you know, numerous scenarios moving forward, whether it be, you know, a full war with Hezbollah breaks out in the northern front, you know, a full intifada style revolution breaks out in the West Bank. You know, for what it's worth, you know, the West Bank and in Israel proper, it actually has been somewhat quiet. You know, we haven't really seen those scenes like we did in 2021 with a lot of the intercommunal violence. So the situation is already in a very bad spot already, but unfortunately there is a lot of possibility for it to get a lot worse. And we're going to run through some of the scenarios on what could happen. So yeah, Kobe, so just, I'll just immediately put the ball in your court. You know, where do you think we're going to be going from here?
So let's start. You made a good distinction between Gaza, the city, and the Gaza Strip. So I want to start just, you know, giving our audience some context. So the Gaza Strip itself is located on the eastern coast of the Mediterranean Sea. It is a narrow piece of land that is approximately 140, I think, square miles, give and take. It's a bit bigger than Manhattan and a part of the Bronx. Okay. It goes about 25 miles, like 40 kilometers from north to south, and give and take between 3.5 to 7.5 miles wide. The current population in the Gaza Strip is estimated to be 2.3 million people, besides approximately 1,000 people that are considered to be Christians. All of them are Muslims. All of them are considered to be Palestinians, of course, and they live in 22 different cities, townships, and refugee camps. The largest one, of course, is Gaza City. Now, we also need to remind people that there is also the Gaza envelope. The Gaza envelope is the territory inside the land of Israel, which is in a radius of almost 7 miles from the border with Gaza. Another thing that we need to remind our audience, that Israel withdrew from Gaza in 2005, which means that Israel went back to the international borders that have been recognized by the world, by the United Nations. And therefore, Hamas could do in Gaza whatever they want. This is not a part of what you can call the occupation that people likes to call. I mean, there are a couple of complexities with our relationship with the Gaza people, but you cannot compare it to what's happening in the West Bank because it's two different things. So, you know, when you're asking me what's going to happen, let's try to go to see a broader picture here. Hamas did surprise Israel, but there are bigger players in this game. Everybody knows, I mean, everybody who follows politics and international relations knows that in the last couple of months, President Biden was trying to move forward in a big, I would say, international maneuver that would have brought the U.S. a big achievement. One of it was to establish, official relations between Saudi Arabia and Israel. Some will call it a peace accords. I will call it diplomatic accords because Israel, just like with the UAE, they were never in a war with Saudi Arabia, and we don't even share borders. While on the other hand, you have other players that have their own interests. One of them, of course, the biggest one is Iran, that is supporting Hamas for years. Even though I will say that if it's up to Iran, Hamas is not different than, you know, any other Sunni. If you're talking about the Muslim world, then you have two big, I would say, streams. The largest one is the Sunni, okay, which is considered to be more moderate, more rational, and the Shia, which are a lot more radical. And they are in a war in between them. If you go back, you know, to the 80s, where you had the Iran-Iraq war, it was a war between the Shiite and the Sunnis. And even moving forward, Iran is quite isolated from the Arab world. But they figured out a way to find new alliances. So they are holding Hezbollah, you know, in Lebanon, which is a small Shiite organization, a terror organization, that actually took the state of Lebanon hostage. And they have Hamas that even though they are Sunni, Hamas is committed to the Sharia law. And Hamas is committed to the nation of Islam. It's a part of the Muslim Brotherhood. So they are not a nationalistic organization per se. They are more of a religious, I would say, radical movement. But they have the shared values of, it works for Iran, who doesn't want any peace and quiet in the Middle East. And with Iran, you have other players like Russia that have its own interest in the Middle East. You know, in Syria, in Lebanon, Putin always have the interest of weakening the U.S. And China, who's been a really quiet player here, they are sitting on the borderlines, but they are voting with Iran and Russia in the UN. So that's something that needs to be said.
You know, it's interesting, you know, now that more news comes out, you know, about the attack and about the planning of the attack, and that, you know, supposedly Hamas had been planning this for a couple of years, this attack specifically on October 7th for a couple of years at least. And, you know, allegedly that Iran gave their support and, you know, allegedly trained some of their fighters. It just so happened now, you know, the Israel-Saudi normalization agreements were looking very legitimate and starting to actually go somewhere. So a lot of people are asking, you know, like, what was Hamas thinking? Like, they knew that that Israel was going to respond like this, where they were, you know, possibly like Israel was possibly going to like reoccupy Gaza and wipe out Hamas as a result of this. You know, what I've been thinking a lot is behind Hamas's motives, you know, kind of like the whole strategic suicide thinking, you know, because a lot of what they were talking about in the Israel-Saudi normalization agreement was bringing a lot of it was really centered around Saudi Arabia, and Israel was just kind of like brought into it, to be totally honest, but bringing Saudi Arabia into a defense pact with the U.S., similar to what we see in South Korea and Japan. And basically, you know, from the Iranian perspective, that was like, that's really a no-go and not something they can tolerate. You know, I know a lot of this is kind of like not necessarily conspiracy thinking, but alleging stuff. But basically, Hamas found themselves in a position where they could throw themselves in front of a moving bus to basically stop the normalization and also just put the Palestinian cause right back on the map. I mean, you know, a lot of people were really just focused on normalization between Israel and Arab states. There was a lot of just like not caring for the Palestinian cause. And I mean, it is fully right back on the map now. So, you know, I don't know necessarily if Hamas is going to, if like the institution of Hamas is going to come out of this in one piece. I'm sure as an ideology, I mean, you know, can stay around for, you know, as long as ideas are being floated around. But, you know, do you think that like this really is more of like a strategic suicide for Hamas, where, you know, they're basically willing to sacrifice themselves in order to derail an Israel-Saudi agreement? Do you still think that Israel-Saudi agreement could happen? Like, how successful do you really think they were with this attack?
So I don't have enough information, you know, about the Saudi-Israeli negotiations. But I will say that you nailed a couple of points here. The first one is that, you know, a part of the paradigms that Netanyahu was promoting was the idea that we're making, you know, a peace for peace. That's how we called it. Shalom tmurat shalom. That we are not offering anything, but we are having peace with our neighbors. For many years, Netanyahu was trying to push out the Palestinian question from, you know, I would say, from the international debate, the international discussion. It didn't make the problem go away. The problem was there. And I think that for Hamas, I mean, intelligence is now saying that they planned it for about a year and a half to 2 years, which is a long time. And actually we have, you know, we have evidence now that Hamas people were trained in Iran and that a lot was going on that Israel was missing. But the fact is that for Israel, Israel has lived under the illusion that we can continue ignoring the Palestinian problem. And I think that it was a really painful reminder that even if we'll have an agreement with Saudi Arabia, the Palestinian problem is not going anywhere and Israel needs to make a decision. And the decision, by the way, that needs to be made is both on Gaza and the West Bank. And it's more complicated, you know, we should have a different episode for it. But Israel needs to decide whether it's holding to the West Bank because of the messianic delusion, you know, illusions of the right wingers, and becoming either a binational state, because it will have to give citizenship to all of those Palestinians if we annex the West Bank, or on the other hand, to make it an apartheid state, because we're not going to make them citizens. Or we are withdrawing, setting up a border, having the world to intervene. I mean, my if I'm talking about the, if we're going back to the disengagement in 2005, I think that one of the biggest mistakes that Israel did was that it didn't say to the, you know, international institutions and to the world, listen, Gaza is your problem. Go and recover it. Gaza, in theory, had the potential, you know, everybody was talking, it's going to become the next Singapore. But Gaza is being held by a terrorist organization called Hamas. Hamas doesn't have the interest to develop Gaza. Because like in any other, I would say, third world entity, it's a lot easier for the rulers to keep the people poor and hungry so they can control them.
Well, Kobe, let me also just intervene. You know, I'd say a major mistake Israel made in 2005, which, you know, we're clearly seeing its effect now, was that, you know, they withdrew the soldiers and the settlers from the Gaza Strip, but they also maintained basically control over the infrastructure. So, you know, the electricity, I believe a lot of the water supply, and, you know, now basically, you know, the thing that's, I mean, excuse me, I'm just shittiest about the situation is that, with the Hamas attack, you know, Israel's response is to basically turn the lights off for everybody, turn the water off for everybody. And that's what draws the world in, is to, you know, get those main facilities back online.
So Israel made actually three big mistakes. First thing, it was not calling the world to, you know, to take Gaza under their responsibility. Then in 2006, Ariel Sharon, who was the prime minister of Israel at that time, he actually promoted the disengagement in order to get rid of, if people remember, I mean, to our younger audience and also to our older audience, the disengagement came as a plan after President Bush came with his roadmap plan. And Ariel Sharon wanted to save the West Bank. So that's one of the reasons that he came with the disengagement. But Israel wanted to keep a leverage on the Palestinians. So as you said, they maintained the control over gas and supplies and water. It's not all of the water, because actually the Palestinians has some desalinization facilities, but those facilities are working on gas. And if Israel is not letting gas in, okay, then you have no electricity and no water in Gaza. And this leverage is actually going against us because people are holding us responsible for any humanitarian crisis happening in Gaza. And it happens a lot every time that Hamas is upsetting us a little bit.
Can I ask, Kobe, I mean, you know, we talk about, like, you know, the border with Gaza and Israel, but I think it's also important to note, you know, for a lot of people, it's not just a border between Gaza and Israel. There's also a border between Gaza and Egypt, which is the Rafah crossing, which is where, like, all these aid development, you know, the majority of aid shipments at the moment are coming from. And, you know, we talk about Israel not letting certain things go into the Gaza Strip, but like, I'm just curious, how much flexibility does Egypt have right now with regards to their specific border crossing with the Gaza Strip?
So let's talk about Egypt and the Arab world in overall. So as I mentioned, Hamas is a very, it's a radical religious organization. It is aligned with the Muslim Brotherhood, which is an international, I would say, affiliation of different branches of radical Muslim organizations that are actually creating a headache for most of the states in the Arab world. If we'll go back to Egypt, then the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt took over the elections in the early 2000s. I forgot the year. I think it was 2008. And it created a chaos.
After when the Muslim Brotherhood won?
Yeah.
I think it was 2011, 2012.
Oh, 2011. Yeah, I thought 28, but it can be 2011. And now, you know, that you have Sisi took over power again, you know, the military took over. Actually, all of their leaders are in prison. The same are for the Muslim Brotherhood in Saudi Arabia and all other Arab countries that may not be, you know, democracies, but they want to maintain quiet. So Hamas is aligned with the Muslim Brotherhood. Egypt doesn't really have an interest to help Hamas. That is one of the reasons, by the way, that the border with Egypt was remained closed, because Egypt didn't want Hamas to get a leverage from their end. You know, the only Arab country that actually supports Hamas is Qatar. And Qatar is it's an interesting case study, because Qatar, after in 1995, they decided they want to be more independent. Until 1995, they were some sort of, under the wings of Saudi Arabia. Most people don't know, but Qatar has the largest gas resources in the world. They are the second largest exporters of liquid gas, second to Russia, by the way. But their reserves are 14% of the world's gas resources, which is a lot. And it makes them a big player, because not only gas, they also have oil fields. Most of the money they make, they are actually making from the oil fields, while they are keeping the gas as leverage against other countries. A part of what they are doing is that they are playing a different game than any other Arab country. They hold, for example, Al Jazeera, which is, the kingdom-owned media channel that slams a lot of the Arab leaders. They are creating chaos, they were creating chaos in Lebanon, in Egypt, in Saudi Arabia. They're giving different reports.
Al Jazeera is also banned in a good amount of Arab countries. I mean, I believe Egypt and Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
I think they actually have an Al Jazeera reporter in jail in Egypt, or mm-hmm. they did for a while. And I mean, you know, it's the regional, it's very much regional focus on the Middle East, but it's banned in a lot of the Middle East. And I believe even in Israel, there's starting to be some rumblings about wanting to ban it in Israel, but we'll see.
And you brought up a great point, because even now that we are at war with the Hamas, there is still an Al Jazeera reporter in Israel. Okay. When you don't have it in a lot of other Arab countries, like you said, because they said that, you know, they are unwilling to have chaos agents in their countries. But Qatar is playing on both ends. On one hand, it's helping to finance Hamas. And I need to say something about it, because Israel is saying the world, we're telling the world that Hamas is being funded by Qatar. I'll just give it as a short briefing. But the Gaza Strip, I would say, yearly budget, is approximately $2.5 billion. Almost $1 billion is being transferred by the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank, controlled by the PLO, by the Fatah, as we call it. But they still support all of the administration in Gaza. Almost $500 million comes from UNRWA. Most people are unaware of, but UNRWA is the refugee agency for the Palestinians. It's the only case that you have an agency just for a specific nation. That's also a topic for another episode, because I actually think that UNRWA should be closed and all of the Palestinian refugees need to be under the regular refugee agency in the world. The rest comes from taxes that Hamas collect, and a small portion comes from Qatar. But why is it important to hear about it? Because Qatar is delivering cash money directly to Hamas. Most of the other funds go through, legit channels. But this is a direct funding to the organization by Qatar. And by the way, talking about Israel's mistake, it was something that was approved by Benjamin Netanyahu. Netanyahu, for years, if we go back to the fact that he was talking about peace for peace and he was trying to eliminate, the Palestinian question and taking it off the table, one of the things he did, he was trying to do, divide and conquer between Gaza and the West Bank. And he was, using Hamas as a leverage against the PLO, weakening Abu Mazen in the West Bank, okay, and helping Hamas to establish their power. And that's insane, because it hurt us quite bad, I would say. In the long term, I don't think it was a good plan. But that's about, Qatar and Gaza. So it was important for people to, I think it was important point for people to know.
Yeah, it's interesting how it's, you always bring me on, in previous years to speak about Netanyahu and his political situation. It's like, in a way, it's still relevant, it's obviously there's a a major war going on that honestly has the capacity to expand into a major regional war, bringing in, you know, superpowers such as the US, bringing in Russia, bringing in Iran, bringing in other actors. Like at the end of the day, Netanyahu being the prime minister of Israel for well over a decade does have a lot of responsibility on his hands, you know, for this like divide and conquer strategy between the PA and Gaza and trying to get the Palestinian, trying to take the Palestinian cause and remove it from the global agenda. You know, how, in light of what happened on October 7th, you know, obviously it was like one of probably the worst security situations in Israel since 73, since 48, honestly, probably worse than both. But, you know, like, how are people perceiving the prime minister right now in light of everything that's happened, in light of, you know, what people anticipate might happen?
So I can share that his approval ratings are even lower than his approval ratings after the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin, which actually will be commemorated on November 4th. It's going to be 28 years to Yigal Zamir assassination of Yitzhak Rabin. Netanyahu was the leader of the opposition, and his approval rates at that time were about in the 30%, you know, of approval rate. Now, as a prime minister, as an acting prime minister, he's in 20% approval rate. If to be honest, I don't understand who are those 20%, but that's something for psychologists to check. But unlike other people, I think that he's going to remain in power.
You do. That's interesting. Everybody, you know, everybody basically, you know, is the whole BB the magician as a politician stick. People think that, you know, it's up. He needs to resign now. You know, nobody really knows when this war is going to end. But, you know, you can assume there's going to be massive demonstrations against him and his government. You know, there already was to begin with before the war. You know, this just goes to show what a lot of people have always kind of known, that this government has been very incompetent since day one. But you're saying that you think he's actually going to persist and will figure out a way to remain in power despite everybody being against him within, you know, both in Israel and honestly within the international community as well.
I'll put my wishes aside and I'll try to bring, you know, an analysis here. Netanyahu doesn't show any empathy to anything. Okay. He still, only yesterday, he found the time to meet with several of the abducted families in Israel. And that was also done with no media, because he's trying to minimize everything. Every media appearance that he has is orchestrated. He's trying to control the narrative. He's trying to control the story. And the fact is that you have no opposition. He said, we need to set up an emergency government. But when he said it, if we'll go back to, you know, Benny Gantz, our friend from the last Netanyahu coalition, then Benny Gantz and Yair Lapid should have told him, okay, you want an emergency government? This should be how the government will be formed. Okay? These are the ministers. We don't need, now we have 37 cabinet members. Okay, do you really need 37 cabinet members? More than that, they're still pursuing, you know, they're still continuing with crazy legislation. Just today or yesterday, they brought up a proposal that the police will be entitled to shoot demonstrators. Okay, if they will promote it, that's not democracy. You know, that's one example. The judicial overhaul is not off the table yet, okay? Netanyahu still has his 64. And by the way, if you're talking about it, it took him 5 days to set up the coalition with Gantz because he wanted to ensure that he still have the 64 out of 120 mandates with him. So he wasn't willing to go with any other proposal that will, you know, get rid of his natural allies, as they call them, that some of them, even now, are trying to, you know, light up the flame, you know, put the West Bank in flames, people like Smotrich and Ben-Gvir. But having that said, as long as he has those 64 mandates, and the more the time passes, his chances of survival as prime minister are growing, I would say at the cost of civil war. Most people will not be willing to retaliate what is happening. there is a growing majority, even among Likud supporters, okay? When we're talking about the approval rates, 60% of the Likud voters say that Netanyahu should step down, that he is the, you know, the cause of the problem. He cannot solve the problems that he caused. And if we go, you know, let's go to economy. If you have a Wall Street company that just, you know, got Chapter 9 or whatever, they will not hold to that CEO. They will replace the management trying to hold things together. And Netanyahu is definitely a part of the problem because most people who serve in the reserve now don't trust him. You can see that his actions are all aimed, once again, to control the narrative, not to really find solutions. And you want, if you know, if you're asking me what Israel should aim for, I honestly think that at this point, Israel should tell Hamas, you guys won this round, because I don't think that we'll get a victory photo. You know, everybody likes to talk about framing a victory photo. We're not going to get our Iwo Jima photo. We can either try and eliminate Hamas, and that will take a heavy toll in losses for both ends, including our abducted, you know, people. Or Israel can do what I think it should do, because we are responsible for our own people, is to tell Hamas, you won this round, okay? But this is a war, so only this round. We're going to prevent humanitarian aid until we know from the Red Cross what is the situation of all of our abducted people. Because listen, Hamas is creating, you know, it's war crimes what Hamas is committing. And we have the right to know what's happening with our people. The other thing is, you want us to stop? I want all of the civilians back. And then release all prisoners after we get the civilians back. Release all of the prisoners that we are holding, the Palestinian prisoners, in order to get all of our, you know, military personnel that is being held by Hamas. But it should be, that should be our main goal.
So you're thinking more, you know, going back to, now we're going back to 2011, you know, with the Gilad Shalit prisoner exchange. For context, Gilad Shalit was a IDF soldier. He got kidnapped by Hamas in 2006. He was held hostage till 2011. They did a prisoner swap. It was like, I think 1,001, 1,000 Palestinian prisoners for Shalit.
1,027 prisoners, if to be exact. Yeah.
So you think that
one of them, by the way, is Yihya Sinwar, which is leading Hamas today.
So you think that should be the case right now?
I think it's different. I think first thing, if we'll talk about the Gilad Shalit case, I think that that was a corrupted deal that Netanyahu made. In my honest opinion, and that's why I think that we should also tell them that for moving forward, the numbers are going to be one per one, okay? One for one, no more than that. I mean, Israel cannot take a chance releasing more prisoners and endangering itself with providing Hamas with 9,000 more potential, terrorists. Having that said, until Gilad Shalit, most of the deals were not that big. And once again, if we go to Netanyahu and why he had, you know, the reasoning to do that, he didn't do it because he cared about Gilad Shalit that much. He did it more because at that time you had rallies in the streets about the economic situation. And he was looking for a way to, to quiet it down. That's why he was willing. And by the way, he was the first one to release terrorists with what Israel is called with blood on their hands, which means that not only that they were involved in terror, they literally shed, you know, Israeli blood. And that was a really bad deal. Talking about Trump, you know, that was a really bad deal. But now, I don't think that we have a choice. All of our options are bad. Because even if we try to eliminate Hamas, and we have the heads on Hamas living in Qatar, by the way, and Turkey, okay, and we don't get to them, then they will form new, you know, you always have, you know, just to remind our people, our audience, we had four different operations in Gaza. In 2008, okay, we had the war in Gaza, but that, by the way, weakened Hamas really bad. Then we had the Tzuk Eitan, Protective Edge, in 2014. Then we had Amud Anan, sorry, in 2012. Then we had Tsuk Eitan in 2014. Then we had Shomer Chomot Netanyahu in 2021. The two last ones, by the way, were not related to Gaza itself, but Netanyahu decided to have two in one. So, but that's, if people will go back to our two previous episodes that we had, then they can check it out. But yeah, I think that we are in a really bad situation. I think that our priority should be returning our people back home and making Gaza a world problem. Because my concern is that if Hamas will still be there, you know, and we're not setting up some sort of a really well-defended border with them, then our people are not going to go back home. And that should be Israel's first priority. And if that won't happen, then Hamas really won. I know it's not that optimistic, but what can I say? My other concern is, of course, once again, that Netanyahu will remain in power because you won't have enough brave people in the Likud to tell him that enough is enough.
Well, you know, I always try and, you know, end things like glass half full, but, you know, things, you know, and I think we both know, like, things are gonna, you know, get worse before it gets better. But, you know, I mean, hopefully, you know, there is some light at the tunnel here, and that, you know, enough people get together in the aftermath of this and just decide, like, nothing like this can ever happen again. I mean, you know, for all I, you know, people are kind of retreating into tribal and ideological, their own sides. But, I mean, you know, it's kind of how life works. And, you know, that obviously there will be some sort of a reconstruction effort after this. But, you know, obviously, I'm sure we'll be back here monitoring and trying to explain and make sense out of the developments as they continue to come along. And unfortunately, I think it'll probably be at least another couple months of, you know, some sort of fighting in the Gaza Strip, at least. And, you know, obviously keep an eye out on the West Bank and on the border of Lebanon and Syria. So,
by the way, you wanted to end with a cup half full. I will talk about President Biden, that I haven't mentioned him. You know, many Israelis, I'm not one of them, you know that, supported Trump. And they said, you know, all of the Trump jokes, of course, of Sleepy Joe and all of that. He proved himself to be, first thing, to be a true ally to Israel. Okay? I don't think anybody doubts his commitment to the state of Israel and to the Jewish people as a whole, by the way. The other thing is, Biden knows diplomacy. One of the reasons, by the way, that he sent two carriers to, you know, to the Middle East area was to make sure that things doesn't escalate, not just by Hamas, but by Hezbollah and Iran. And also to ensure, by the way, if we mentioned China and you mentioned, you know, then China wants to invade Taiwan. I assume that one of the reasons that he sent those carriers were to show even China that if we have an ally in trouble, they will have our backs. So that's the half full cup of somebody who knows diplomacy. And I can definitely say, thank God for President Biden. And I hope he remains as, you know, as president for 4 more years.
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, if we're talking about polls, his numbers aren't looking great right now. I mean, obviously, you know, foreign policy is never really what drives the American voter, but, you know, I'm sure,
yeah,
you know, people look at instability in the world, whether if it's Ukraine or Middle East, and want to point a finger. So, you know, again, we'll see what happens with Biden as well as Netanyahu, as well as the region, and as well as, you know, the planet that we live on. But looking forward is the best word, but you know, I'm here and ready to speak with you next time you call me up, Kobe.
Definitely, Jeff. Thank you very much for being with me again. And thank you all for joining us for another episode of Balagan. If you find it valuable, please share it with others. Thank you, Jeff.